Welcome to Season 2 of For the Love of Jewelers, a podcast connecting people engaged in the craft and industry of jewelry making. Brought to you by Rio Grande Jewelry Supplies and hosted by yours truly, Courtney Gray. While navigating through this time, we realize the need to stay home, be safe, and stay inspired. We are truly all in this together. I'm honored and excited to take you on this journey to discover not only the how, but why we make jewelry. My goal is not only to inform you, but to empower you by sharing the passion, perspective, and perseverance of your fellow makers and professionals in all facets of the craft. Let's dive in. Alex Boyd is a jeweler and educator. Born into a family of artists in Denver, Colorado, it's no surprise that Alex found himself on a creative path as a young teen. With a ceramicist for an aunt and a jeweler for an uncle, Alex dabbled in just about every art form before landing on glasswork in his early 20s. Alex now creates works of bold contrast using primarily high carat gold and oxidized sterling silver. Along with his powerful pieces and precious metals, he is known for keeping us all laughing with his incredibly creative anecdotes on social media. All right, guys. This is Courtney Gray. I'm here with Mr. Alex Boyd, alexboydstudio.com. Is that right, Alex?
That is correct.
Yay. Pull up his work if you guys are around a computer and check it out while we're talking. Really beautiful stuff. Well, I'm glad to get to connect with you today on For the Love of Jewelers. How are you up there in Colorado?
You know, considering what so many people are going through right now, I'm doing great. I kind of hate to say I'm doing great when there's so much suffering going on, but, I got a great studio to work in. I've got a great girlfriend. I just got a puppy.
Aww.
I don't know anyone personally who's really gotten super sick. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm one of the lucky ones for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is good to say we're doing great. You know, it's allowed for sure. Alex, I want to talk to you about your work and the progress you've made over the years, and start off by just seeing if you would share with me and the community here a little bit about your family. Guys, I don't normally do this to like read from somebody's post, but Alex has been cracking me up. Everything he posts is hilarious and just very imaginative, and I really want to get into how your brain's working. where are you coming up with these, you know, stories but I love this one. I'm going to read it before we talk about your family a little bit and your mentors. But it says, Alex Boyd was born into a family of artistic genius. His mother was a mime who never broke character. She taught Alex all about invisible box construction, walking into imaginary windstorms, and how to climb unseen ropes. And then it goes on, and it's hilarious. You guys need to go and check this out. Alex's father was an infamous poet whose dirty limericks are still banned in many states. His uncle is a renowned tinkerer whose facility with baubles and trinkets has no equal. His aunt is a well-regarded hip-hop dancer known for inventing twerking. So I know none of this is true.
Well, my uncle is a renowned tinkerer.
Well, that part's true, Michael. Yes, and I know Michael Boyd is one of my favorite designers and jewelers. And
Mine too.
Yeah, I bet. And would you say, maybe tell us like about some of your biggest influences and mentors?
I would say my biggest influence is definitely going to be my mom. She's just one of those people who can really take on any medium and do it well. She's got a degree in fine art printmaking, but she's a good jeweler. She's, you know, a great textile artist. She's an amazing gardener, and she's just really anything she puts her mind to, she can do. And she just kind of was always putting things in my hands to work with growing up. So I never had that kind of upbringing where when you tell your parents you want to be an artist, they're like, don't you want to get a real job or, you know, any of that. It was always just almost expected that I would be some sort of creator.
That's awesome. And you worked in glass first?
Yeah, glass was my first medium. I had a friend of mine who, he was actually a pipe maker, and I got to go see him work with glass and make pipes. And I was like, that is amazing. I don't really want to be in that world, you know? I want to do something that I can like show to my grandma. And,
right.
But I was so amazed by seeing that molten glass flow and the things he could do with it. And I learned that actually for a lot less equipment investment, I could start making glass beads. And I thought, well, that's what I'll do, because then, you know, I don't have to feel like I'm kind of, you know, I don't have any problem with what he did, but it's just not me. I'm more of a goody-goody, I guess. I wanted to just be able to show off my work everywhere. And I started making glass beads, and almost, I would say, like my second glass bead, I was like, this is all I want to do all the time. And I would spend probably, you know, 8 hours a day in my studio on top of having to have a job as a barista or construction work or any of the other tons of random jobs that I've had. And so I was probably working like 80 hour weeks, just totally obsessed with it. But I found after a couple years of really investing my time and money and energy into it, that I was hitting a price ceiling hard. I was making these glass beads that might take me 4 or 5 hours of continuous focused work to make. And people didn't want to pay much more than like 60, 70 bucks for them. And that just, you know, it was bankrupting me basically to do that. And so I thought, well, maybe I can start putting these glass beads into pieces of jewelry and, you know, connect some metal parts with them, make them bracelets, make them necklaces, and be able to sell them at a price that will pay me at least to make it. You know, I'll at least cover materials. And I'm amazingly fortunate to have an uncle who is a genius metalsmith and lapidary. And he lives about an hour and a half south of me or so. And I asked if he could show me how to do some metalworking. And I drove down to Pueblo, and he put a jeweler's saw in my hands, gave me a little strip of silver and some half round pliers, and said, here is how you make a ring and how you solder it shut and hammer it round on a mandrel. And I made like 5 rings, sliced my fingers like 3 or 4 times in a couple hours. And
rite of passage.
Absolutely. Still is.
Right.
He gave me a few basic metalworking tools. He gave me a jeweler's saw, gave me maybe a file or two, and kind of sent me on my way. He recommended the book, The Complete Metalsmith by Tim McCrate. So I ordered up a copy of that, and I just kind of in my basement put together a real, real rough metalsmithing studio, and started making little like end caps for my glass beads and running wire through the beads and making little loops that connected so I could make a bracelet or a necklace, and reading and trying everything I could from Tim McCrate's book. And after probably 6 months of that, I realized I'm barely touching glass at all anymore. I'm almost purely working with metal. And it's kind of been an obsession ever since.
Nice. Yeah, that sounds like, I was going to ask you that question actually, Alex, is, you know, do you remember the moment you made the choice to do jewelry full time? And that kind of answers it for us is, you know, so did you fall in love like you did with the glass? Did you have that same like loss of time slash,
absolutely,
I yeah. love this, you know, and I just can't walk away from it. Very
yeah.
nice.
I had that, you know, when you, all of a sudden you're working and you feel really ill, and you look up and you realize you haven't eaten anything in like 10 hours and you're going to pass out.
Not with the torch on. Yeah.
Not with the torch on.
I have a colleague who literally fell asleep with the torch. He was up soldering so late. He just, thank God he's okay.
That is dangerous.
Yes. Set a ping on your phone, guys, or something to remind you to get up from the bench and stretch, move around, get the blood flowing, and yes, eat some protein, right? Oh my goodness. So how long ago was that when you really like made the choice to say, this is going to be my career path?
I would say it was 14, 15 years ago.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we can call you, you're a master. We can put you in the master, you know, over a decade. Well, I don't know. I don't really know how we can count that yet, but.
That is a word that you'll never hear come out of my mouth.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
To describe myself at least.
Yeah.
I feel like it's only for other people to say, but I'm definitely enthusiastic.
I love that. We'll put you in the enthusiastic category.
I've made my living off of it for the last probably 12 years or so.
Nice.
It took a while to get to where I made more money than I spent on it.
Of course.
And
yeah.
A longer time after that to get to where I could actually pay my bills with it and I didn't have to have a bunch of other jobs.
Mm-hmm. What would you say was like the most influential job that you did have as you were, you know, starting to work and learn and grow? And was there a job that stood out to you before jewelry?
Before jewelry, I was a handyman for a home builder.
Ah.
And I got to take part of so many different processes involved in renovating and building homes. So I would do tile and paint and put windows in and really almost everything except plumbing and electric. Did a little framing, did even some roofing. And I knew that I loved building things, that I went to bed at night feeling really satisfied with my day, like I had accomplished something. And that's key for me. If I do work that doesn't have a tangible product at the end of it, even if I work my butt off, I don't feel like I accomplished anything. And so knowing that I've created something that it didn't exist before I need it for my, yeah, for my mental health.
For sure. Yeah, I get that. I get that. And I worked in a lot of different crafts before metal, glass, ceramics. And, you know, the one thing that I really realized about metal was the permanence and the longevity of the material. I mean, this is, you know, material that can be buried in the dirt for centuries and we can still access it. It doesn't break when it hits the ground. You know, you can run over it with your car, et cetera. but yeah, I totally get that. I think that's probably why you've become such a strong jeweler. When you say is the engineering that's involved in that handiwork totally relates.
I think the biggest thing that taught me how to be a jeweler was I got a job at a jewelry shop in downtown Denver called Gusterman Silversmiths, and doing repairs was really, it was like jewelry grad school, where I had a decent skill set before I got that job, but I was just making my own work and I wasn't solving other people's problems. And once I got exposed to all this different jewelry and really had to think about how to repair it without destroying it, it gave me a skill set that I then took on to my own work and really expanded what I'm capable of.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I bet. I mean, trying to repair, especially when, you know, sometimes you can't even identify the metal or if it's been soldered before. We've all been there, you know, those of us who've done repair or even made our own work sometimes trying to fix a problem. I think we learn so much by that.
Absolutely.
Those troubleshooting moments, you know, and honestly, I think that's what makes a great instructor as well. You know, when I worked with a lot of different teachers, I would always look at, one, the student work, and two, you know, are they making, are they active, is this jeweler, are they able to navigate and troubleshoot with the students? I would say working in repair, I bet that feeds your instructor abilities, your ability to kind of, because man, students will bring up some strange moments, you know, where it's, oh, I've never faced that one before. How are we going to figure it out together? You know?
Yeah. And yeah. I'll often swoop in and save the day when they think they've wrecked something. I can come in and do some of the skills that I wouldn't have as a pure studio jeweler. They really come in handy to get that student back on track so they can keep on moving with the class and they don't feel kind of demoralized by messing something up.
Mm-hmm. Or defeated, like ready to throw it across the room and quit. Yeah, that's a huge skill that I think we build from just simply making, you know, repetitively over the years. When did you start teaching, Alex?
So initially, I got my first teaching experience with being a teacher's assistant for my uncle. And I would say that was maybe 10 years ago or so. And that was amazing because it's basically like taking his class for free or getting paid to take his class. I didn't get quite as much time on the machines as the students did, but I got to hear everything he was saying. And, I did it, you know, I've probably been his teacher's assistant a half a dozen times or more. And, that's the initial teaching experience. And that really helped me to get a grasp of how to structure a class and how to communicate effectively with students. And then I would say maybe 5 years ago or 4 years ago, I started working with the Boulder Metalsmithing Association. And that was huge because she kind of took a chance on a teacher who's, compared to most teachers, I was a lot younger than the teacher she was hiring, probably by, you know, as much as maybe 20 years. And I got to learn how to communicate with my students, how to structure these classes on my own terms rather than going with what my uncle was doing. Because while my uncle is, he's brilliant, we have very different ways of thinking.
Right.
And so being able to teach there really was huge to getting the confidence. You know, I remember the first time I taught there, I was so nervous. I had like a stomach ache driving up to Boulder and my hands were clammy and I was probably mumbling and stuttering half the time. And I just kept going back and teaching more. And now, I mean, it's kind of... I liked getting nervous and overcoming it. And now I don't get nervous at all when I'm teaching. It's just like, oh, this is my job. It's what I do.
That's awesome. Yeah. It sounds like the first time I got on stage, you know, we were playing music in the garage for like a year with my husband and I have a band together. And, you know, we had three other guys and they're like, so when are we going to play out on a stage? And I was like, we're not doing that. I'm safe here in the garage, you know, but, you know, and the more you do something, I think the easier, more natural it becomes. I do still feel butterflies every time I get on stage or every time I teach or do an interview like this, Alex, honestly, like anything. And I think that those like those tingles that we feel are more what I try to consider as preparation. It's like without that, we may not go in prepared. So
absolutely.
It's like useful, you know, butterflies. I don't know. So what do you love to teach the most now that you're, and how long, yeah, you've been teaching for a while now and assisting, what's your favorite thing to share with others?
You know, my most popular class is a class I teach called Gold on a Budget. And over the years, you know, I started making jewelry basically right when gold became insanely expensive. Or maybe I started using gold right when it became insanely expensive. I was making some things in copper and silver before then, but I've never known affordable gold. So I developed some techniques to use really small amounts of gold and stretch it a long, long way. And I developed a class to share those techniques. And that's a really fun one because, like, people get really excited when they've been scared of gold and all of a sudden feel like this thing that was intimidating to them is approachable. And it really can open up a lot of doors for their work. It also, it helps jewelers sell work. You put gold in a piece and it's a lot easier to make a living as a jeweler. You work in pure silver or base metals, even if that work is some of the most amazingly technically difficult and beautifully designed work, a lot of your average customers don't have the appreciation for that that they do of like precious materials. And I mean, that's a little sad because like, I think that the real source of value in the world I want to see should be human labor rather than the preciousness of a resource. But it is also the world we live in. And I want to be able to pay my bills, you know, so putting a little gold here, putting a little diamond there. If that means I get to do what I love for a living, it's a sacrifice I'm willing to make. It's also beautiful, you know, 22 carat, especially I do a lot of work combining 22 carat with oxidized silver. And I just love that black and yellow combo.
Yeah, it's so much more pronounced with the black and silver, you know, the darker versus light. It's gorgeous. I love the textures that you use too. And you do a lot of the gold. And then I was looking at your work and every piece of it, some of your work is textured, every little spot. Talk to me, just can we talk about texture for a minute?
Absolutely, yeah. So a big part of why I texture so much is post-traumatic stress from being a polisher. When I first got hired at Gusterman Silversmiths it might have even been a year, my job was to saw sprues off of castings, file that sprue down, and then polish that piece up using Tripoli and rouge. And I did so much of that that now the idea of polishing, just like my hands get clammy, I get all nervous, not again. And I just was like, well, what can I do to not polish? I'll texture. Then if I polish, it's just removing texture. It's just going to hurt the piece. So that's kind of where my love of texture began. And then over time, I've really refined the textures that I use and kind of made like almost a fingerprint of my work that has a specific style of texture.
Yeah, it really stands out in your work for sure. So it's almost like from necessity, you create the recipe. you know, it's all the polishing. I think that's the most common question. The common comment that comes up with jewelry makers is, you know, what's your least favorite part? And it's like polishing. But, you know, we've got to do it. And I actually honestly used to really love polishing. Like in the beginning, just seeing that, you know, everything was shiny. I was just like, let's make it all shiny because look how shiny we can get it. But then I, you know, as time goes on and the rouge stains your fingers, you know, it's time to get creative. But yeah, I really love the texture in your work because it looks like something kind of dug up from the earth and, you know, kind of ancient. Is that an important or a prominent design approach for you?
Absolutely. So when I was a little kid, I was obsessed with ancient civilizations, real ones and fake ones, you know, like Atlantis. I could not get enough of that stuff. And one of the kind of ways I describe my aesthetic is that it comes from like an ancient advanced civilization that has like disappeared. But somehow they were capable of doing things that we can't explain today. Mm-hmm. You know, like the pyramids and Stonehenge and all of these things that are just, they kind of defy our conceptions of what the ancients were capable of. And I think that's a real big aesthetic inspiration for me.
Yeah, I can tell. And it's also creates a really cohesive feel to your work. Like I know when I'm looking at an Alex Boyd piece, you know, which I think is important for makers to, you know, once they kind of get into their craft and really want to build a career, I feel that cohesive look and a line is important. Do you do mostly one of a kinds, or are you doing a line of jewelry or one-offs that you just put out there for sale, Alex?
I would say it's almost all one of a kind, but if I make a piece that someone sees and loves, I'm happy to make something similar to that piece again. But I don't do production work. I don't build multiple pieces at a time. I always do one piece at a time. And I always, even if I am making something similar to something I made before, I like to change some aspect of it. I want to feel a sense of growth with every project. And I mean, that's ideal. I also live in the real world where sometimes somebody wants something that is exactly like the thing they bought for me last time because they want to give it to their sister or a family member to have this shared piece. And I totally do that. I'm not that big of a diva.
Yeah, you say yes. Well, especially that's special. Then you're creating this heirloom quality to the work, and it's got that importance to the people that are receiving it, which I think is why we do custom in general. You know, is that one-on-one relationship for me anyway? I think that's true. I'm looking at your gallery on my other screen, Alex, and oh my gosh, guys, you have to go to alexboydstudio.com and check out the gallery. There's so much work here. And do you have like a favorite piece that you've created, like the process, like everything just flowed and the outcome was really powerful?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've got this, it's a Sleeping Beauty turquoise bracelet that I made, with pure, all natural, unstabilized Sleeping Beauty, and 22 karat, 18 karat sterling silver and diamonds. And that piece, it took like a year to come together. I cut the stones and then I decided what to do next and really never knew how it was going to end the whole time. I was just like, well, what's the next step? What's the one thing I can do to it now that won't screw it up? And I would do that. And then I'd let it sit for a while and come back to it when I had another idea. And I love that piece. It's got this really cool box clasp that is two pieces of Sleeping Beauty that fit real well together with a little diamond in the center. That's the button for the box clasp.
Nice. Yeah. Did it sell, this piece? You still have it?
It did sell. Yeah. I made it to enter it into the Sawbell Awards. And then I was about to box it up and send it off to be photographed by a professional photographer because I just couldn't do it justice on my own. And like the day before I sent it, I got a message from Molly Bell asking if I wanted to be one of the judges for Sawbell.
That's right. Yeah.
And there was a little small part of me that was a little disappointed because I was like, no, I have a piece. I'm going to enter this piece. I've never had a piece ready for Sawbell.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, I could not say no to that honor. You know, that's like one of the most privileged positions I've ever been in was to be asked to be a part of that.
How fun.
It was amazing.
Viewing all that work and just, oh my gosh, yeah, some spectacular pieces that, like you said, look impossible, like the pyramids. You know, how did you make this? And yeah, I really love seeing the winning pieces and even the pieces that get entered is unbelievable stuff. You know,
yeah.
Well, you can still, you know, there's still a lot of other competitions out there, right?
And yeah,
probably more to come.
A couple months after that, it was honestly right around the time that COVID was obviously going to become a thing, that piece sold. And that that was really nice. It gave me a lot of, you know, a big safety valve for not having shows that I could go to, not being able to teach. And also, you know, a lot of people were scared about their finances, so they weren't as willing to buy jewelry like they had been in the past. And the fact that that piece sold gave me, you know, a couple months mortgage payment.
Awesome.
So I didn't have to freak out.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm hearing different responses from what's going on in buying habits and, you know, how that's working for jewelers, especially with the lack of shows. And it could be that the future is quite different. I did want to talk to you a little bit about your thoughts on that. But first, let's talk about, I got to read another Alexism. And I think you need to write a book, because I think that's the next chapter. I'm going to encourage you to make a book of Alexisms, or come up with a better name. That's terrible branding. But on social media and marketing, guys, Alex Boyd is inspired by the constant need for praise and validation. Taking inspiration from algorithms, he strives to create whatever gets the most heart responses. Alex seeks to discover the perfection of nature and get as many shares as possible. Someday, overcoming the crippling shame of being told by his father that he can't sing and he's too knock-kneed to be an Olympic runner. Man, you just crack me up. Like I said, I've been reading these to my family over the last couple of days, and we've all just been laughing, which is so healing right now.
I'm really glad.
You just, yeah. Like, do you sit down and these just spill out of your brain, or
I definitely have dry spells where I've made some piece that I'm like, oh my God, this piece of jewelry is amazing. I want to share it, but I don't have anything funny to say about it.
Like we said, no pressure, right?
But usually I can sit down and something will come to me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just, when I first started trying to really market my work, I would read about people who are kind of marketing gurus saying your work needs to have a story. That's how you connect with people. And I thought the real story of my work is, like, I loved that color and I loved that line and texture. And so I decided to make this thing. And honestly, while that's real interesting to me, that's a really boring story to share with other people. And I thought, well, maybe my story doesn't have to be true. And if it's really obviously not true, then it's funny.
Right.
You know, it's not like I'm lying to my yeah. clients. I'm just sharing some joy.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's much needed. And, you know, and it does get so repetitive. It's why I'm inspired by nature, or I'm inspired by this line, you know, or this era of artwork or what have you. And so these just have me cracking up. You guys need to check out Alex on Instagram too. And what did you say? Follow you there, and they get to have the Alexisms as well when you create new work.
Yeah. Honestly, Instagram is the number one place to find my work. I don't update my website as often as I should, so there's way more work on Instagram. And almost every piece has a story or a little funny thing to go with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. It's really hilarious. Would you say social media is, like, really where you're finding new customers and creating an audience?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Before I really got invested in social media, I hit a lot of roadblocks with the kind of art world gatekeepers. You know, even if you're really talented, not saying that I was at that time, but even if you are,
enthusiastic,
it's a lot about relationships and connecting with people and having people who you meet and like you, and then want to work with you. And I didn't have a lot of people who met and liked me at that time that were like gallery owners or things like that. And being able to kind of sidestep that and just get my work out there on my own, allowed me to get the audience that you need to make a living as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been great. And now I've got a few galleries that I work with that are amazing, but I'm not sure if they ever would have known about me if I didn't find a way to get myself out there first.
Yeah. Yeah. And are you posting like daily or, you know, just as much as you can to kind of stay in front of your audience?
You know, I don't post daily. Sometimes I post daily. It really depends on how busy I am, how much work is getting produced. Some of my pieces might take a week or two to build. So during that time, I might not post anything because a big part of it for me is I never want it to feel like marketing. I don't really like being marketed to. And I don't want people to feel like I'm marketing to them. I want people to feel like, honestly, like I'm showing off, like I'm just being a little bit of a braggart. Here's this thing I made. Because I think that feels better to people than getting this, like, here's this thing I have for sale. You should buy it. And there's enough of that in the world, you know? You can't really go anywhere without seeing somebody trying to tell you to buy something.
No, it's so true. It's so true. And now with the, you know, the new ways of kind of hearing us without even knowing what, I mean, I can mention something I want to buy and all of a sudden I see all these ads for it and it's just so much. So it's nice to see somebody stepping outside of that box a little bit and creating more engagement and, you know, humor than sales or, you know, yeah. And marketing is creative. I really think it can be very fun. You know, that word has such meaning to all of us, but if we shift our perspective a little bit about it, it can become more of an engagement tool, I think, and a community builder.
For me, I think of marketing as more of a side effect of what I do rather than the goal. I really am. I've always been like a mom, look at me, mom, look, type of person. I've never been shy about showing off what I'm doing. And I think the biggest inspiration for posting on social media is really just to show off what I'm doing. And then the fact that sometimes I sell work from that is just an added bonus.
Yeah. Yeah.
I must not have gotten enough attention when I was a
kid. I don't know if any of us did. That's too funny. What are your thoughts now? I mean, without the potential of shows, and we're really, I think, having to fill the gap with going online and online teaching. And so you're juggling online classes now and creating. How many pieces are, like, on average are you doing for clients, would you say?
I would say I make probably maybe a dozen pieces a month.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And then I also, and like some of that is not stuff you'll find on social media because it's work that is designed to satisfy a client's needs, not my own. And mostly what I post is the work that was built because I wanted to make it. I also do some trade work for other jewelers. I do a lot of fabrication and stone setting for other designers in Denver. A few different jewelry shops have me do their repairs. So I stay really busy.
Sounds like it. Yeah.
And honestly, I have to. I would love to say, like, I could live the good life just on my art selling, but I'd be eating some thin gruel every day if I relied just on my art. And also I really enjoy doing repairs. I love the puzzle aspect of it. And I love taking something that has a lot of emotional meaning to somebody and they're kind of distraught because it's broken or damaged. And I take it in and I bring it back to life. And, you know, I would say the most satisfied customers I have are the people who, like, their grandma's ring broke. And I did like 15 minutes worth of soldering and rounding it out. And then I give it back to them and they're crying. They're like freaking out.
Isn't that awesome?
An easy job.
Yeah. And that's so cool. You're the magician, you know? Yeah. I think half of being a jeweler is being somewhat of a magician, you know, if it's not working, make it look like it's working, you know, kind of thing. Do you ever find yourself like seasonally with a lull of creativity? I know as creatives, I started charting my seasons like years ago, like, okay, the end of the year, I'm very kind of unmotivated and uninspired. Do you have kind of a flow or seasons to your creativity?
I wouldn't say I have a seasonality to it. I definitely have times where I'm incredibly inspired to get in there and make something that I imagined. And then I have other times where I don't really have that fire under me. But I really made a point of showing up and working either way. I feel like if I let the fact that I'm not inspired stop me from getting to my bench and making things, I'll stay uninspired longer. And I'll kind of lose some of my self-esteem as well. I think maybe unhealthily, I've got a lot of my self-worth tied up in being creative and productive. And so even if I'm not really excited about what I'm creating, the fact that I did it anyways still like lets me like myself.
Yeah. And then you get that tangible reward at the end of the day, like you described earlier. You know, I think that's makes a lot of sense. We could all relate to that. Is there something in particular, Alex, you want to take a sip of water?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, take a moment here. I'm just going to mark it so we can take a big breath. And because you've been talking a lot and you're doing so good.
You know, I heard one time, I think it was something Prince said about his work ethic. And he was saying that if he wasn't in the studio working, then the muse was going to go give Michael Jackson that song.
And I
love that. I do definitely think like, I'm not a super woo-woo kind of spiritual person, but I do have this sense sometimes that my creativity isn't necessarily all me. Like it's something out there in the universe and it's channeling me at times. And I feel like if I'm not at my bench, it is gonna go somewhere else. It needs an outlet.
Yeah, and I can do it.
And I don't know, honestly, when I say that, I'm like, I don't know if that's true, but it's really a productive way to think, regardless of its truth. It keeps me in the studio and it keeps me working. And like I said before, the more I'm working, the less I feel those creative doldrums.
Mm-hmm. The lulls or the, repetition too. And getting, I think that was some of the best advice I ever heard was just get your body to the bench and the rest will, you know, will channel, like you said, and will kind of flow. And some days are going to be really productive and some will be disastrous, you know, or we'll have those challenges that just nothing seems to go right, et cetera, such as life, right?
Yeah.
I love that though, that just keep yourself motivated. And you know, of course, making a creative passion into work is something to navigate. Can you talk about a little bit about what that was like for you or?
You know, honestly, I don't know if I'd recommend it for everybody. I think we have this sense in our society that like, if I've got this hobby I love, I should try to find a way to turn it into a business. Like a just kind of a hustle kind of ethic. And I don't think that's necessarily for everybody. There are definitely people I know who had a great love of jewelry and tried to make a business out of it, and they don't like making jewelry that much anymore. And I think they maybe would be happier if it was just a thing they did on the side rather than making a bunch of production work and going to shows all the time. Some people love that life, you know, and it works great for them. And I definitely think we need to know ourselves and what works well for us. I think, honestly, if I had to do like trade shows and travel a bunch for work, I would probably not enjoy myself as much. I really am in a lucky position where I, because of social media, I can reach a global audience without having to leave my studio. I think it's obviously right into this day and age been huge for me because nobody's leaving.
Right. Everybody's home. Yeah.
Yeah. But even if there were, you know, the ability to travel and everyone was attending shows, and it's not a lifestyle that I'd really enjoy.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of work.
It's, you know, so much work. Yeah. I didn't think I understood that before I was a working artist, and I went to, like, the Cherry Creek Arts Festival is a big one that comes to Denver every year. And I would just go and look at all the beautiful art and imagine, wow, that looks like such a cool job. You just get to make this stuff and go show it to people. And then I did, you know, I've done a handful of ACC shows and a bunch of local art festivals in Colorado. And it's as hard as building houses, you know?
Yeah.
It is not easy work by any means.
Yeah. And it's from the ground up, right? Just like, you know, foundation to roof.
And it can be emotionally brutal too, because, you know, one of the things that happens with social media is I don't get people who don't like my work interacting with me. I really get pretty much only positive reinforcement. And when you're doing a show, like I did a show where this lady walked up to my booth, looked at my work, and then said, meh, and walked away.
You're kidding me. Wow. And, you got a meh.
You know, I know my work's not for everybody. Absolutely. I don't want to make work that's for everybody, because then I don't feel like I would be being honest to my own aesthetic. But I don't want to know that they didn't like it.
Don't tell me that you don't like it. I get that completely when I share new music with a friend. And, you know, it's the same with a song. It's not going to be for everybody, you know. But if you can grab that one person out of the audience, or, you know, that one person from a show who becomes a lifelong fan and buys your work repeatedly or comes to see you perform whatever it is that you're doing creatively. I'm like, just, you know, listen to it and just don't tell me if you don't like it, you know, just leave it alone or lie to me. I'm fine with that. You can lie, you know.
I've got a handful of people in my life who I'm really comfortable taking criticism from, and I really respect their viewpoint. And so if they give me criticism, I'm all for it. It'll help me grow. But it's a small group of people who I feel that way about. In general, I'm much more of the, yeah, lie to me. If you don't like it, just lie to me.
Just give me that heart, you know.
I also think if a piece of art is designed for everyone, it's probably not very good.
Yeah, it's very, well, yeah, or kind of like a house that's cookie cutter, so to speak, or something is what I'm envisioning as we talk about building and how that relates.
I think it's designed for a customer who doesn't have a strong sense of their own aesthetic values and is looking for cues from the world for what they should consume. And that's not my customer. You know, I want that person who knows their style and thinks this fits me.
I love that. Yeah. I think it's important to zoom in on what kind of people you are creating for, you know. I think it takes a minute in our career path to kind of get a handle on who is that ideal customer for you. Do you find any commonalities in your customers? Like, certain personality type or, I don't know, character, et cetera?
You know, I would say my best customers are jewelers. I think I'm kind of an art jeweler's jeweler in a way. Like, I do a lot of work that's really labor intensive, and I don't think that a lot of people who don't have kind of an education in maybe not jewelry, but at least craft, have a lot of respect for the labor that can go into a piece. So I would say, like, that's the most common thing that my customers have, is there some sort of craftsman or artist.
So they can relate to the labor involved. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's great. I love that. All right. You want to do some rapid fire? Are you up for this?
Let's do it.
I'm pulling this out for you, Alex, you know, because I just think it's going to be fun. All right. So no thinking, just answering off the top of your mind. And
I never think before I speak.
It would be a problem. Awesome. All right. Most inspired part of the day for you to work?
Morning.
Favorite place to create or to come up with ideas?
At my bench.
Of course. Easy one. Favorite color?
Green.
Like your eyes, right? They have like really, really intense green eyes.
Like probably 75% of my clothing.
Yeah.
Almost everything I own is green.
Oh, I love it. I love it. One habit you're working towards altering?
Better time management.
Elaborate on that for just a second.
I just have times where I don't order what I need to do in the most efficient order. And I don't believe that life is about always being as efficient as possible, but it really can help, it can help pay your bills to be a little more efficient and thoughtful. And sometimes I just kind of spin my wheels a little bit and don't know what I should be doing next.
And balancing time with family and energy and all of that.
And I'm getting better at it. I definitely have made strides in that direction. It helps. What's really helped more is the more my own work pays for my living, the less exhausted I am, because I'm trying to make my own work and satisfy all these demands from the outside world. So I think a big part of getting better at it has just been having more energy to devote to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Balance. It's a big win for all creatives, I think, for sure. Biggest strength of yours in your eyes?
My abs.
I was waiting for you to pull out the abs or the hair regimen.
Great glutes too.
I love it.
I think my greatest strength, I don't know if this is really true or not, but it feels like to me is a capacity to take my work incredibly seriously, but not take myself seriously, and having that space to know that, like, what I really do is make pretty things for some of the most privileged people in the world. And I love that. It's great, but it's not saving babies from diseases in third world countries. You know, I don't work for Doctors Without Borders. I have a job that I think putting beauty into the world has a lot of value, just nowhere near as much value as like helping other human beings not suffer does. And so I always try to have that self-awareness that what I'm doing isn't that important, but I still treat it like it is when I'm at the bench. I still, I need every surface as perfect as I can make it. I need every moment as focused as I'm capable of being. But I don't want to be a jerk. I feel like a lot of the time people who take their work really seriously can be a little dry and a little unpleasant to be around. And I don't want to be that.
I like that. I like that's a good way to approach your creativity. What do you want to be when you grow up?
A fire truck.
I knew you were going to make me laugh. A fire truck. Okay.
That is, that's what I used to say when I was a little kid. When people asked me what I wanted to be for a long time, it was a fire truck. And they thought I meant a fireman.
Yeah.
And I didn't. I wanted to be a fire truck.
The ladder, the whole bit. Yeah.
I've come to realize that's not technically feasible. But a boy can dream.
Yeah, you can. I love that answer. So that's a great segue into this question for you too, is from your age today, what would you tell your younger self, or what advice would you give Alex Boyd maybe 10 years ago? Or
just that it's going to be okay. And even if it isn't, all the anxiety that you're feeling isn't helping you. None of the anxiety got me any further. So I would just say, like, yeah, just work your hardest and don't worry about too much.
It always works out one way or another.
Well, and even if it doesn't work out, by worrying about it so much, you just suffer twice. You just suffer before it all comes crumbling down, and then as it's all crumbling down.
And it makes it harder to handle, I think, too, because we're worn out already, you know, worn out with worry. Yeah.
And anxiety eats up so much creative energy, too. I mean, I think I'm a little bit of a like congenitally anxious person. I've always been, as long as I can remember, I've always been a little bit of a worrier. And I think that has maybe helped me to not take myself so seriously. I've like as a coping mechanism for that. But it's never done me any good.
Yeah, that's not the preparation butterflies we were talking about earlier that are actually helpful or useful. It's more useless suffering for sure. So from your age today, what advice would you give your future self? Same thing, chill out.
Yeah, probably the exact same message.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Maybe eat less carbs.
There you go. For those abs, you know.
Yeah. I'm not going to get away with this forever.
It's right. Alex, can I ask how old you are now?
I'm 37.
37. Oh, that's an awesome age. I say that about my, you know, every age. That's an awesome age, you know. I have two boys and they've been awesome at every stage.
Yeah.
Sometimes a little more difficult to handle, but mostly just like, wow, just so such different. We've our perspective and everything that shifts as we grow as humans is kind of such an adventure.
I love it. I find the older I get, the happier I get. And I'm sure at some point there might be some physical issues that come into play that make it harder to be as happy, you know, when your body hurts all the time, it can be difficult. But I'm hoping that's a ways off. And I try to take pretty decent care of myself to postpone that as much as possible. But especially emotionally and mentally, the older I get, the better I feel.
Well, and the wiser we get too, I think we start to let go a little bit more of worry, hopefully, and the anxieties of, you know, when we just know less or haven't experienced as much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, like, life's easier now. You know, I used to have to scramble a lot harder to pay my bills and have a home and all of that. And as you get older, ideally, making a living becomes a little easier. That honestly might be a huge part of why I'm happier now, is because I'm not working 80 hours a week in order to have a still kind of just scrape by sort of existence. I'm working just like 50 hours a week, and I'm pretty comfortable. You know, I've got a house in the hood on a busy street, and it's small, and my truck is 20 plus years old. But, you know, I'm in my studio every day. I've got a beautiful girlfriend. She's a great jeweler. Her name's Bailey Acebo. So we really share this passion. We can nerd out on jewelry all the time. I've got the cutest puppy ever. And
what's the puppy's name?
Lieutenant Ellen Ripley.
Oh, now I love it all even more. Yes.
We just call her Ripley, though.
Ripley. Nice. Yeah. So behind the scenes, Alex and I were just talking and he showed me a beautiful piece that he's working on. It looks finished.
It is finished. Yeah.
With the sapphire. Tell me about the stone again.
So it's a color change sapphire from Umba, Tanzania, cut by Anna Gilbert. She's on Instagram under Treblegana, which is just Anna Gilbert backwards, but it sounds, you know, exotic.
It does.
And she's an amazing gem cutter. She cuts these really, really different shape stones. And so I had her custom cut me this color change teal sapphire and put it into a ring. And I think on Christmas, I'm going to ask her to marry me.
Oh my gosh, that's so exciting. Yeah. And it won't publish till after Christmas. So decided.
So,
okay.
So if she says no, I'll have you cut this part.
Yes, then let me know. What would you say to somebody out there, Alex, who's just kind of getting started or learning about the tools? And I mean, it's kind of like to your past self question that I asked, but maybe you have something else to share.
I would just say that it can sometimes feel like you're not making progress and you're not moving forward. But if you could step back and see, you know, where you'll be in a decade, you will be amazed by the progress that you're making as long as you just keep working. And so just put your head down and get to work. And things will happen. And a lot of the things that will make you a successful artist, not just professionally, but creatively, they don't come all at once. They come, you know, like individual grains of sand that eventually build up to a giant sand dune. You know, it's definitely worth just keeping at it. I think I spent a lot of time waiting for some kind of big break, and I never really had a big break. I just had a lot of little breaks that added up to this life that I feel so fortunate to have. And that's what I would say.
Yeah. Perseverance, you know, just one day at a time, one grain of sand at a time. I love that.
And maybe I'd also say make art for yourself. Like, you should always be your primary source of aesthetic choices. You know, we all need to make compromises to pay our bills, but your work should be made to please you first and others second.
Yeah, I think it speaks through the work too, you know, the intention set behind each piece or the way that you approach each process. It really shows in the final product. Yeah, I love that. Alex, thanks for sharing with us and taking time out to chat with us and to share your thoughts and your experience with the community. We love all of you guys. Anything else you want to say?
Just thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thanks for tuning in, you guys. I hope you have enjoyed this episode of For the Love of Jewelers. Stay tuned for the next episode by subscribing through Spotify, iTunes, or by searching podcast at riogrande.com. I encourage you to rate us, write a review, and share with friends and colleagues. I hope you're all finding ways to stay inspired. I'm your host, Courtney Gray. Until we get to connect again, onward and upward.